Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
And we have all experienced some of that feedback. Oh, you know, such a lowly job. You do what? Oh. And we find it to be really gratifying.
Lynn Schwartzberg is talking about her work with One World Catering. We hear her story of food, from hobby to career, and we bake up some scones with Marie Shakespeare. Before the sweet treat, leafy greens with Daniel Orr, two different ways to enjoy kale. And Harvest tells us that science is making better seeds with the help of better data. There was a lot to keep track of in the news the past several days. Mark Chilla gives us a summary.
Annie, federal officials this week released details on President Trump's proposal to cut a quarter of the budget of the food stamps program. Changes include limiting the number of adults without dependents who get benefits, lowering the minimum benefit level, which is currently $16 per month, and capping eligible household members to six. Acting Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Michael Young says a big chunk of savings in the proposal would require states to match up to 25% of the SNAP money provided by the federal government.
This would be phased in over a time period. The estimated 10-year savings for that proposal is about $116 billion.
Congress will ultimately decide whether or not to follow through with Trump's proposals. Lobbying groups that represent Midwest and Great Plains farmers and ranchers are urging the Trump administration not to upset trade relationships while making changes to NAFTA. President Trump has made it clear that he wants changes to one of the country's most influential and controversial trade agreements. Trump spent the 2016 campaign blasting the deal as terrible and a job killer. Canada and Mexico, though, are two of our top markets for agricultural goods. Trade associations for corn, wheat, and soybean growers all say the deal that's been in effect since the mid-90s is a net positive for American farmers. They'd rather it be left alone. U.S. farmers exported $39 billion worth of agricultural goods to Canada and Mexico last fiscal year. And recent reports of doomsday flooding at the Doomsday Seed Vault in Norway have been greatly exaggerated. Well, sort of. A barrage of breathless headlines last week declared that water had leaked into the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, a facility designed to safeguard global crop diversity. The leak happened in October 2016, when extreme rainfall and high temperatures caused permafrost to melt and leak about 50 feet into the vault's entry tunnel. The water then refroze. But as officials at the facility told Popular Science, the seed bank itself was never under threat, and there was simply, quote, no flooding, but more water than we'd like. The entry tunnel has been leaky in previous years, and groups operating the facility are working on better waterproofing. The inner facility itself has additional safeguards to keep water from threatening the seeds, including pumps and a downward slope in the entryway. Keep a close eye on our Twitter feed to get more stories like these 24/7. We're at Earth Eats.
And we're at eartheats.org, too. Okay, Mark Chilla, thank you.
Happy to help.
Generations of farmers in the Midwest have searched for the perfect seeds for their crops, and plant breeders have tried to create them. Now that pursuit's gone high-tech, think statistics, computer coding, and lots of math. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains, the next generation of farmers will rely on big data.
Walking into a lab at the Plant Sciences Institute at Iowa State University, I expected microscopes and maybe grow lights over tiny shoots.
Solar power will connect via this cable.
Instead, I found a lab worker, Nathan Smith, surrounded by cameras, about 1,000 small digital point-and-shoot cameras, plus waterproof cases and cables. So many cables.
And then these USB cables will connect to these ports over here.
The Institute still has greenhouses and traditional wet labs, but the time-honored tradition of cross-breeding plants again and again to get the best traits is no longer the primary way the science gets done. These cameras, for instance, will help razor-focus experiments, saving scientists loads of time. Mounted on poles in fields, the cameras will take pictures every 10 minutes while the corn grows. ISU professor Pat Schnabel heads up the Institute.
We watch plants go through their normal growth and development, and also we watch them respond to environmental stresses like drought and so forth.
Watching plants grow might sound like a snoozer to many of us, but for the scientists, those cameras are capturing potentially revelatory details about the plants. Once the human genome was sequenced about 20 years ago, plant breeders could adapt that breakthrough to mapping plant DNA. Then, the research possibilities exploded. But to make use of them, Schnabel says biologists needed ways to handle copious amounts of information. Think one photo every 10 minutes for months, times 1,000 cameras. Schnabel needed different expertise from computational scientists and engineers.
What I've discovered is that if we can describe interesting hard problems, engineers like interesting hard problems, particularly if they have some clear impact in the world.
Say they're looking for a seed that will grow taller plants. Engineers create sensors to gather information. Computational scientists write code that pulls out the useful bits and bytes from all those image files the cameras make. And then the biologists do their job.
Using statistical approaches, which didn't exist 20 years ago also, we can make very strong hypotheses about which genes are regulating height.
By marrying the data science to their genetic interpretations, Schnabel says his team sees results faster, and that leads more quickly to new seeds in the marketplace. This isn't just theory. The Swiss agricultural company Syngenta has an entire group dedicated to computational science.
You can see a nice map of North America.
Analyst Mark Hamilton pulls up software that can crunch through heaps of data. He can layer the map with soil type, average temperature, or the density of acres planted in soybeans. Then he can ask the program to show him how different seeds performed.
Its average yield is 65.2, and it's winning by 1.5 bushels versus a competitor. So all in all, that's a very strong product.
Syngenta's Joseph Byram, who leads the company's computational sciences team, says agricultural researchers can learn from how other companies exploit data science.
How do we bring, mathematics to a field in the way that it has in a lot of other industries, whether you're FedEx, Chevron, Microsoft, Google? Now it is time to bring that to agriculture.
Advances in technology have always changed our food system, and big companies like Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta have massive research budgets. Big data is the latest interdisciplinary approach. Byram's team includes biologists, agronomists, mathematicians, even an experimental physicist. He says once you present a problem in a way everyone can work on, the broad-based approach to solving it reaps rewards. And that, in turn, attracts top talent.
There's this impression that this type of innovation needs to, occur in Silicon Valley or a place like Boston. And, the level of innovation that's actually occurring in Des Moines, Iowa, I think is extraordinary.
And oh, by the way, the rent's a lot cheaper on the prairie than on the coasts. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Farmers markets are picking up speed this month, and we're celebrating veggies that are always there this time of year. We did asparagus and cauliflower. Swiss chard was earlier this month. And today in the kitchen, another leafy green, kale. Daniel Orr gets the oven warmed up for the first recipe, and the second one is raw.
We've got this beautiful dark purple kale that has this nice kind of almost neon-looking center stem, bright purple. What we're going to do is we're just going to pull the heavy stems out of those and put those to the side. Now, you can put those in your compost. You could chop them up and throw them in a soup. You could braise them with some lentils or something.
Can you pickle them?
These could be pickled, too, yeah. And lots of fiber in those. All right, so I'm going to pull the purple leaves off here first. Then I've got our more traditional green curly kale. And you want to leave the pieces fairly big because we're going to be making kale chips today. And they're a great alternative to potato chips. They're very elegant. You can serve them with cocktails. You could serve them just with any kind of snacks. And then finally, I've got this real long kind of tongue-shaped kale, if you have a real big tongue. And we're going to take this off and leave these in nice long pieces.
The Gene Simmons of kale?
Yeah, exactly.
That's incredible how you're doing that. You're just running your fingers along the stem and the leaves are just coming right off.
Right off, and you leave that whole big stem behind. Okay, and you could make these just plain with just a little touch of olive oil. That's pretty much all you need right there. That would be about for 3 or 4 cups of kale. That would be about a tablespoon of olive oil. And put a pinch of salt. You got to be careful with the salt because these are going to cook down and it's easy to oversalt greens. All right, so it's better to undersalt than to oversalt. A little bit of fresh ground black pepper, and you could do it as simple as that. I'm going to kick it up a little bit with some curry, so a couple good pinches of curry, and a little bit of garlic powder, okay? And then we just simply kind of massage the oil and seasonings into the kale. So now we're just going to lay these out on a sheet tray with no additional oil. And those long ones you may want to break in a couple pieces, but for presentation you really want some nice big long pieces in there. All right, so now we just put these in a 250 degree oven. It's a nice slow oven, and you cook them for about 25 to 30 minutes. And the magic of radio.
Ta-da!
They come out like this. Okay, and then for presentation I like to put them in a rocks glass, and so those nice tall ones kind of stick out of there. Put in a couple of the purple ones for color.
You can hear how crunchy they are.
Oh yeah, they're super crunchy. They're delicious. I love these things, and a great way to get a little kale into your life.
And now a salad with a little help from some fresh lemon juice.
All right, so we're just going to cut this really, really thin. And that's really the most important part of this dish because you're cutting it so thin that it's going to become tender when you massage it. Today we're going to use good olive oil. And this is the time where you pull out that expensive bottle of olive oil, you know, that $15 bottle, because you're using it raw, and that's how you're going to taste a good olive oil. A good pinch of freshly cracked black pepper, a good pinch of kosher salt, and then I'm going to chop up some mint, and that's going to give the salad a nice lively flavor. And again, you don't need to mince it up too fine. We want to have that mint kind of in every other bite, so not every bite tastes the same. We're going to add a little bit of lemon juice, and we're even going to take a little bit of that peel. You could take a vegetable peeler if you've got good knife skills. Just cut a little strip off there, and we're going to do what we call a brunoise. And a brunoise is a very fine dice. I'm going to add just a little bit of orange juice, fresh orange juice. Then you just get in there with your fingers and really work it. We're really going to massage it like it's got a big backache. And then what that does is it tenderizes it and makes it easier to eat. And I'm going to give it a little taste. Now, I added just a little bit of salt. Again, greens are easy to oversalt, so you always can add a little more, but you can't take it out once you put it in there. So, I think you guys are going to love this.
These recipes are at eartheats.org. Coming up, baker Marie Shakespeare.
All right, scones. What is a scone? It's a sweet biscuit, I guess.
Sweet biscuit?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a breakfast.
You've had scones.
I know, but I can never really, like, I guess they're triangular or square. They tend to be crunchier and maybe more brittle.
They should be flaky. I've never had a flaky
scone. You have not had a flaky scone?
Teach me.
All right.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail,
More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. I'm Annie. You're listening to Earth Eats. President Trump campaigned on plans to pull out of large international trade deals. Instead, he wants to focus on one-on-one agreements with other countries. But that has farmers worried they'll lose some of their $135 billion in goods they sold overseas last year. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted explains.
Rancher Mike John in central Missouri is checking on a herd of 100 or so of his cattle as they graze on rye he's planted. The group approaches us thinking it's time for a grain feeding.
They look like my dog when I'm about to feed my dog.
That look on their face like, okay, we're here.
2 years ago, John was looking forward to seeing the meat from these cattle shipped off to hungry eaters in Japan. He was ready for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a massive trade deal among 12 countries, including the U.S. and Japan. It took 8 years of negotiations to get everyone to agree to lower tariffs. Some economists expected the pact to add $3 billion to the U.S. agriculture industry. But President Trump called the TPP a disaster and pulled the U.S. out.
We were very disappointed. TPP was going to be a victory for us. It was going to open some markets and lower some tariffs, and those are the things that give you access.
Consumers in Japan have a growing taste for high-quality American beef. But today, the beef that John produces faces a staggering 38% tariff to get into Japan. The TPP would have slashed that number to 9%. Now that TPP is dead, John's eager to see the next move.
There is no question that every industry wants to grow and flourish, and if we're going to do that with 96% of the world's population outside the borders of this country, we have to trade. We have to export our product.
Even more unnerving is the recent news that Japan has pitched the idea of a mini-TPP without the U.S. Not everyone agrees free trade will benefit the U.S. economy, though, especially when it comes to saving jobs. The Trump administration wants to hammer out bilateral deals with TPP member countries, starting with Japan.
Strikes me that the trouble with doing bilateral agreements is there's a lot of countries out there, and so they're not going to get to everyone this year or even in this term.
Blake Hurst is the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Remember, 8 years to make the TPP. Knocking out 11 bilateral deals could take much longer. Hurst recently spent time in Washington lobbying alongside dozens of other heavy hitters in the ag industry.
There is concern in the agriculture community about the rhetoric that the new administration has used in our trade relations.
Bottom line, there's only so much beef Japanese shoppers want. And today at the supermarket, they're choosing between an American steak that's more expensive thanks to higher tariffs and an Australian steak that likely costs less.
That playing field's not very level when you think about the differences in tariffs depending on the country importing product to Japan.
Scott Brown is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri, and he says it's not just about Mike John and his American-grown beef. So negotiations won't be easy or fast.
Those that care about agriculture in the United States and Japan are going to be different than those that might care about, let's say, cars or electronics. And all those deals work together.
The benefit of a big multi-country trade deal is that it can open up many markets. Say a beef industry hurt by competition in Canada can gain market share in another, like Japan. In a one-on-one deal, there's less to go around, so a deal directly with Japan could be difficult to negotiate, and farmers worry it won't have the same impact. Ultimately, American beef production is going up. Ranchers produced more than 25 billion pounds last year. Those steaks need to find international dinner plates so that the U.S. ranchers can make some money.
If we have to eat it here, it comes with lower prices to make consumers decide that they want more beef. So that growth in supplies needs a home, and frankly, that home needs to be outside the United States to keep prices higher.
Whether that beef finds a home in Japan could still be years away. In the meantime, farmers are going to have to settle for their current trade relationships, at least as long as those last. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
More at harvestpublicmedia.org.
So I told you that we're baking scones today with Marie Shakespeare. Come into her kitchen with me. She's a part-time baker at One World Catering, a job she's worked for only a couple years. She came to the professional food world later in life, and because she thought it'd be fun. Now, as Marie puts it, she's part of a team of ladies of a certain age who do a lot of the baking at One World. But okay, let's start with these scones.
We are in my kitchen in the south side of Bloomington.
Where it all started.
That's where it all started, oh sure, yes.
Okay, what are we doing today?
We are going to make apricot almond scones. I'm also a lighting designer, and I teach lighting at IU, and my students are forever misspelling sconce as a scone. So on the last day of class this year, I brought them these scones and said, these are scones. They don't light up, they're delicious. And so that is what we're gonna do.
Okay.
So there is a filling part to the scones that have apricots, honey, lemon peel, lemon juice, and water. And that needs to cook a little bit, and then it needs to cool before we mix it into the dough, because scone dough has cold butter in it. So I've learned from doing this wrong a number of times to make it, chill it, cool it, get it to a nice, happy temperature with the other ingredients. So we do that first. Everything in there now, it just kind of sizzles away for 10 minutes or so.
Then she puts this mixture in the fridge to cool it down. She sifted the dry ingredients together.
I am now involving the wet ingredients with the dry ingredients with my gloved hands, trying to get things evenly moistened. And it's crumbly. It's a crumbly dough, but when I knead it a little bit, it'll come together.
But it shouldn't be too uniform, because you don't want to overwork the dough, or it'll become tough. You can see the little pebbles of butter throughout. Then she rolls the dough out into thick discs and uses a straight edge to cut them into sixths.
Now,
don't saw at the dough or twist your cutter.
When you cut it, you have to go straight down.
Like little sconelets.
Yeah, baby scones.
What we're looking for is scones that rise nicely, they don't tip over, and you can see the layers.
They have some of the lovely characteristics of a croissant without the incredible time and pain of making croissants. I made them a couple times, and that's when Lynn said, oh, you can make a croissant. You could work for me. I'm like, okay.
My name is Lynn Schwartzberg. I'm the general manager of One World Catering.
Lynn also started as a home baker. She was running a small business out of her kitchen called Bakery Girl.
And I wasn't sure I was ready to have a full-time life doing it. And I was going to use some space here. And Jeff said, oh, we'll never use all this space.
That's Jeff Meese, co-founder and CEO of One World Catering. He allowed her to use space in their professional kitchen.
So he brought me over and, you know, the kitchen was quiet and the walk-ins had all this space in them. And I thought, oh, that could be interesting. And then I decided I hated my job. So I sent an email out to a very small group of people that knew me in various ways. And I was very honest. And I said, this is my skill set. If you ever think of anything that you could use me for, I'm looking to change my life. And I got an email from Jeff, and he said, why don't we go have breakfast?
That was 5.5 years ago. Lynn started out working 20 hours a week, mostly baking for One World. As the business grew, so did her responsibilities. She realized she needed help with all that baking. And that's where her friend Marie Shakespeare comes in. Marie has always worked lots of little jobs, from teaching lighting design classes at Indiana University to teaching yoga. She always tries to work a toy job, she calls it. She makes a little money doing it, but it's more about the fun than anything else. Well, a couple of years ago, her toy job just wasn't cutting it anymore.
And then, I don't know, just things always change and shift. And there was one day that I said to myself, you know, I wonder if I'm really still having fun here. I think I'll write down every shift I work, kind of on a scale of 1 to 10 about how much fun I'm having. And that lasted like 2 shifts, and I went, I'm not having fun anymore. That's just wrong. So I quit. And then Lynn said, I really do need help in the kitchen. You want to come and cook? You want to come and try it? It'd be fun.
So she came over and started baking, and she's particularly skilled at scones, coffee cakes. She's kind of a breakfast baker, muffins, and she was terrifically helpful.
I strive to work 12 hours minimum a week, and my goal is to make enough money to pay my health insurance premiums. I have lots of other little jobs here and there, but this is my toy job.
It's really funny because we live in a community where it's full of academics and it's full of professionals, and being a regular worker is not exactly idolized. And we have all experienced some of that feedback. Oh, you know, such a lowly job. You do what? Oh. And we find it to be really gratifying. So we've had, you know, there's a whole class struggle that we've experienced, which is really weird.
Okay, there's the music. Oh, and I smell them. All right, Nina. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, those are done.
They're so much taller than the dough that you put in.
Because of that's the cold butter.
That's the cold butter?
The cold butter releases steam as it heats and does magic.
Oh, these were good. I became a scone believer that day. The recipe is just as easy as can be, and it's on the website right now. There's another recipe there from Marie Shakespeare and Lynn Schwartzberg of One World Catering, a cookie recipe that actually uses the same ingredients as these scones, just with room temperature butter. Marie is right, baking is magical. Check out the recipes and the photos of our day together at eartheats.org. Oh hey, we have a new cookbook. Came out a couple months ago and we're very proud of it. I'm excited to talk about the book in New York at the Book Expo of America. I'll be there on Thursday, June 1st, and I'll also be setting up a table at Blooming Foods on the west side of Bloomington to sign copies of the Earth Eats book. That'll be on Monday, June 5th. Details about these events on our Twitter feed. If you're around, stop by and say hi. And no matter where you live, you can buy your own copy wherever you buy books, online or at your local bookshop. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Good times. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.